Good to see this number at Sunday school this morning. Good to see these youngins here. Appreciate you parents bringing them. We are in Acts chapter 27. I think we'd started, barely touched on the first verse, but so this is going back to Festus and Felix and Agrippa, and all of them had tried to figure out what Paul had maybe done wrong and never did find anything worthy for him to even be held captive or killed by any means. But Paul had requested to be sent to Rome. And the reason being, there was a work there for him to do, I believe wholeheartedly, that he was to stand there. He would be there to Caesar's doorstep, and he would be handed over that way. But the 27th, 28th chapter is a whole lot about his journey of getting to Rome. And we touched on in that first verse of chapter 27, the book of Acts, and when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, and we recognize the "we" is of Luke's writings. And in the next verse, it'll mention one's name is Aristarchus of Macedonia, of Thessalonica. And we've read about him before, and that we believe that he's a faithful follower there of Paul and helped serve him and will continue to do so. But so that's what we're going to be studying about today, and y'all feel free to add in and feel free to help us all just learn together. That's what Sunday school is all about. I know it sounds like a modern term, but we are to learn of him. We need to spend a little bit more time in our Bible searching through some of these things and trying to understand. But the meticulous writings of Acts is pretty good anyway, but it seems like the detail that goes into this 27th chapter, just recognize that Luke is writing it. Luke is a physician, we're told. He's not a mariner. He's not a seaman. He doesn't understand necessarily all that there is to know, but the accounts that he gives in this travel, you would about swear that was his occupation. He gives detail of where they're going. He gives detail of wind direction. He gives detail from this place to this place, and it's just very meticulous writing. So this is kind of unprecedented in virtually any part of the Bible to have this kind of detail to where they're going and where they've been and things like that. So just kind of keep those things in mind as we read through this. But we'll start there in the second verse. "And entering into a ship of Adramidium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia, one Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us." And we want to go back and read where we picked him up at. If you look at Acts chapter 20 and verse 4, you'll see that when Paul had made that Macedonian call, he had already been there once, and now he's over there, and he's actually coming back up. And in the fourth verse, "And there accompanied him unto Asia, Sopater of Berea, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus and Secundus, and Gaius of Derb, and Timotheus, and of Asia, Tychicus, and Trophimus." So that was the ones that was actually traveling back with him, heading into Jerusalem. But Aristarchus, that's where one of the first places we read his name. And then he would follow Paul from there all the way into Jerusalem, and then all the way now heading back towards Rome. So just a little bit of back history there. And then in the third, "And the next day we touched at Sidon, and Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go into his friends to refresh himself." So they've left the coast of Caesarea. They're heading north there by ship. I should have brought that map up here. I'll grab that in a minute. But so he's heading north. Now keep in mind, he's being held by the Romans. He's been put in custody of this one named Julius. And Julius is very accommodating to Paul right off the bat. We don't really understand why, but it really seems that he's going above and beyond to comfort Paul in a couple of different areas that we'll read throughout this. But they're heading up the coast, and they stop, and keeping in mind that Paul had been kept there in Caesarea for a little over 2 years. Bless you, sister. Thank you. So he had been there pretty much kept in a jail for over 2 years, and this man decides, hey, we're on our way up. Why don't we give Paul liberty to go see some of his buddies and maybe get refreshed a little bit? Now, would that have been maybe giving him a bath or maybe shaving him up or something like that? But I believe spiritually he got refreshed there too. And he knew he was going on a journey that he did not know the outcome. He just knew that he was going to be there. And we'll see that throughout this. So he's been down here at Caesarea. He's on his way back up, and they've stopped here at Sidon. That's where they're at right there. But eventually, going all the way over here to Rome, over here. So they'll come up this way, and that's this orange path. So this was made years ago when Brother Jeff had done a similar study on this, and that's been really helpful. And on the 4th, and when we had launched from thence, we sailed under Cyprus because the winds were contrary. Now, when it says under Cyprus, that's where you got to understand different ways that it refers to under, whether they were on this side or this side, depending on here in a bit when we get down to Crete, it'll talk about it went under. But when they come here, they talk about but went under. But you'll see in just a bit that this travel, they're actually going in between Cyprus and in this area of Cilicia. So they're going to just travel right through here. And now why is that? And we'll read in just a second that the winds were contrary. The ideal thing would have been to left here at Sidon and come all the way over, maybe go through this area, take a shortcut, and come up in here to this area, and then maybe take by land as opposed to traveling all the way around by ship. But right off the bat, they're traveling at a time to where it's not necessarily good for travel. It's almost considered the winter months, and we'll get into that here in the writings in just a little bit, but just keep that in mind that it's almost like they're forcing this travel, and they are. They wouldn't necessarily have to go. If this was just a luxury trip, they wouldn't necessarily be going at this time of the year. We refer to it here in when you think of the Atlantic Ocean in our side, you would say that it would be hurricane season. So just keeping those things in mind. Because it says there in the 4th, we sailed under Cyprus because the winds were contrary. Now, I don't know if any of you have been on a sailboat or if you go down to the ocean, maybe even you'll see these little catamarans where they run like the little sailboats. You know, it's got the outriggers on them. And I think the last time we had all went down to Florida, me and Daniel and Cameron, I think it was just us three went out there. This guy rented you like some time. He would take you out, but you'd jump on there with him, and he'd run up and down the coast, and it really didn't matter. He could run up and down that coast pretty much north and south where we was at, but it didn't depend on the wind. He would just turn the sail a little bit, and he would catch that wind, and one way definitely was faster than the other, but he could basically, instead of running in a straight line, you would maybe, if you were going this way and the wind was blowing this northwest direction, you would have to take a bow around this way. But if the wind was coming this way, then you would have to kind of bow up this way and go around. So that was what was going on here. Was the wind was blowing contrary to the way that they wanted to go to give them a straight line path. So the wind was blowing in a way to where they decided they were going to have to take the long way around. And maybe it was picking up a little bit, and they didn't want to get too far off the coast as well. So thought that it might have been easier sailing. And when we had sailed over the Sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. So that's when they were coming down into here. This Lycia is mentioned, this Myra is mentioned. So they're coming through here, this little inlet in between these two areas, and they're going to pass by this way. And there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us therein. So this is, they don't have a specific ship that's dedicated just for transporting prisoners. This man, this man named Julius, they've made it his job to get all these prisoners there. Now, he's jumping whatever ships that he can to go all the way to Rome. They didn't have a dedicated ship. So we recognize that they have found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy. So this is probably a merchant ship. Alexandria is a city of Egypt, which is way down south. You can see it listed right here. So this ship was traveling kind of this direction, but his end goal was to come all the way to Italy. So they've purchased, bartered, or he just took command of, whatever, but he's planning on putting these, Paul and some of the other ones that's traveling with him, he's going to put them on that ship, and they're going to go that way. So he's out of Alexandria. This would be his home port, this ship. And when we had sailed slowly many days and scarce were come over against Cnidus, the wind not suffering us, meaning it wouldn't allow us, we sailed under Crete and over against Salmone. So now they're passing by this way, and now they're sailing under Crete over here. And they're going to go to that fair havens. And hardly passing it came unto a place which is called the Fair Havens. Nigh whereunto was the city of Lycia. Now when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished them. So we're going to understand that first of all, that fast is referring to the Day of Atonement. And this is where we get what time of year that they were sailing in. When they're referring to that Day of Atonement, on today's calendar, if you were to look it up, it'd be referred to as Yom Kippur. And that is the holiest day of the year for Judaism. And the central themes are atonement and repentance. And they observe this day normally with a day-long fast and intensive prayer in the synagogues. And again, this is only done at a certain time of the year, and we can see when that would be. If you'll go to Leviticus 16 and 29. Leviticus 16. And this shall be a statute for you ever unto you, that in the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, you shall afflict your souls and do no work at all, whether it be one of your own country or a stranger that sojourneth among you. For on that day shall the priest make an atonement for you to cleanse you, that ye may be clean from all your sins and before the Lord. It shall be a Sabbath of rest unto you, and ye shall afflict your souls by statute forever. And the priest whom he shall anoint, and whom he shall consecrate to minister in the priest office in his father's stead, shall make the atonement, and shall put on the linen clothes, even the holy garments. And he shall make an atonement for the holy sanctuary, and he shall make an atonement for the tabernacle of the congregation, and for the altar, and he shall make an atonement for the priest, and for all the people of the congregation. And this shall be an everlasting statute unto you, to make an atonement for the children of Israel for all their sins once a year. And he did as the Lord commanded Moses. You can also see that in Leviticus 23. We'll just read that as well. 23, 27 through 32. Also on the tenth day of this seventh month, there shall be an atonement. It shall be a holy convocation unto you, and you shall afflict your souls. And that afflicting the souls is that's where they get the fasting from. And offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. And ye shall do no work in the same day, for it is a day of atonement to make an atonement for you before the Lord your God. For whatsoever soul it be that shall not be afflicted in that same day, he shall be cut off from among his people. And whatsoever soul it be that doeth any work in the same day, the same soul will I destroy from among his people. Ye shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. So, we'll basically, both of those are saying the same thing, but that's what this is referring to. Now, this seventh month, because their calendar started in what we would refer to as the third month, right? So, their seventh month is long about our tenth month. So, this puts it in our late September, early October. Their month don't line up just exactly with ours. It goes by moon phases and things of that nature. So if you're putting this on a time frame, middle of September, October range, and that is considered here like our hurricane season. So trying to understand what type of conditions that they were sailing through, in the Mediterranean Sea, and that's where this is, they don't refer to it as a hurricane. They refer to it as a metacane, meaning Mediterranean Sea and hurricane. They blend those two words. So that's since 1948, I think there's only been 100 hurricanes documented in that area. So it's not near the hurricanes that we would have. I think maybe we might have had somewhere around 100 in a season at one time. You know, so it gets way on up there. Well, not in a season. It's like 50-something, I think, somewhere around in there. So couple of seasons we would have had 100 hurricanes, and they've only had 100 or so since 1948. So they don't have them as often, and evidently the reason being is like what you see here, there's so many peninsulas, there's so many little islands, there's all of that stuff that's sticking out that when those tropical storms start, they need fuel. They need a lot of heat. They need a lot of moisture, and they need nothing in their path to build up steam. Well, it's a very dry climate over there, so it doesn't have the moisture that what we have down in our Atlantic area. And it's got all of those peninsulas and things like that out there that keeps it from building up so much steam. It may get 40, 50 miles per hour, and then it hits land, and then it kind of dwindles out. So to hit a hurricane, what is it? It's got to hit so many miles per hour. I ain't just exactly sure what it is, but that's one of the reasons why. But it still doesn't mean they can't have a lot of big storms over there. And I think that's that's the main point to understand. Any thoughts on any of that so far? So just trying to, again, keep those things in mind is what they're about to go to. And said unto them in the tenth, sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage. Now, what he had just mentioned at the very last of the ninth, and I should have spoke to that, it said, Paul admonished them. And in that ninth verse, admonish would mean to, I had that listed out. So, let's say, to warn or reprimand someone firmly, advise or to urge. So that's what he's doing in this admonishing them. And he said unto them, sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and ship, but also of our lives. So Paul's letting them know that this is about to get serious. Now they don't take him at his word. Here the 11th said, nevertheless, the centurion believed the master and the owner of the ship more than those things which were spoken by Paul. So you got the man that owns the ship, and he, this is what he does for a living, and he's saying we can make it. Now, is that due to the lust of money maybe, or doing a work for Caesar himself that maybe they've commandeered this ship and saying, hey, we got to get these prisoners over there, and not necessarily letting common sense reign here. And Paul, he's been in this region for the last 10 years. From coast all the way around it. He's sailed across it many times, and I believe he's got some real good experience, although he's not a mariner himself, but he's been around and seen a lot, so I wouldn't have dismissed that for certain. So I think one thing there to keep in mind, we can't just take good judgment and common sense and throw it out the window just because somebody else there may have a scientific belief there. And again, maybe that's another thought in a study. But with that being said about this this man that appears to know more about, and earlier we touched on Luke's writings and how accurate all of this is. And we always want to be able to find truth. I love for some of our today scientists and some of our today meteorologists and things like that to line up with something that would have been written somewhere back in the, well, early first century. We'll say somewhere between 50 to 60 A.D. is when this would have been written. And you'll take some of today's understandings and they match that to the Bible and say, you know what, that's very, very close. So there was actually a man in the late 1800s by the name of James Smith that he wanted, even in the late 1800s, to go and try to account for all of these descriptive writings and to see if what Luke had written was plausible. Was the path, was the wind direction, how did all of that line up during this Medicane season that they were having in the Mediterranean? And this was a man that had roughly around 30 years of yachting and shipping and things like that, that he didn't spend it all in that region, but he went to that region and he wanted to try to understand if that was true. So this was somewhere, like I said, somewhere, I think they said his life was 18, or actually late 1700s up to around the 60s or so of the 1800s. But this would have been somewhere around 1844 and 1845 that he wrote this book, The Voyage and Shipwreck of St. Paul. And his book, after going to this area, and his study and finding all of the sailing in this area, that his final conclusion was that a voyage was a true account of real events written by an eyewitness. He said there's no way somebody that was not a mariner could have wrote these things and not have to have been there. So that's further proof that Luke, that would have been the one writing this, that he had to have been there to have experienced the things that they ran into. And he said that there's no way that a sailor could have written a narrative, or no way that someone that wasn't a sailor could have wrote this narrative, and unless it was from observation. And it said Luke describes Eastern Mediterranean ports of call, wind direction, and mentioned places of safety and danger for ships, and even historians argue that all accounts are accurate. And this one of the this is one of the most vivid pieces of writings in the whole Bible. Its details regarding first century seamanship are so precise, and its portrayals of conditions of the Eastern Mediterranean so accurate that even the most skeptical have even conceded that it had to have came from a similar voyage in the very least. So even somebody that just totally wants to discount the Bible with the writings that he put here, well, it wasn't Luke, and it had to have been stolen from somebody else's writings, because, yeah, we even account for things that no man could have just dreamed up without being there or to have stole it from some other writer. So I really, really enjoyed reading about that, but again, a man by the name of James Smith had written that book, The Voyage and Shipwreck of St. Paul, if you'd want to check that out. And there in the 12th, as it talks about, because the haven was not commodious to winter in, so it wasn't comfortable, it wouldn't be the right atmosphere to have wintered a ship in the more part advised to depart thence also, if by any means they might attain to Phoenice, and there to winter, which is a haven of Crete, and lieth toward the southwest and the northwest. So what they're talking about, so they wouldn't stay here in the middle of Crete, where it's referred to as the Fair Havens. They actually wanted to come to the side of Crete, where it laid north to south. and it kind of runs there on an angle. And they thought that would be the better place to go. But what happens? You'll see just as soon as they take off, the wind picks up and it drives them south. They can't even hold the ship to head northward because the winds are blowing so hard that direction. That's why you see this dip in this path, that it's actually driving them down into what they show here on the map is Libya and whatnot. That's North Africa. It's a place. It's a place right on the far side of Crete. Good question there, Steve. I wish their map showed that, but it doesn't show that. So that they might attain to Phoenice, and there to winter, which is a haven of Crete, and lieth toward the southwest and northwest. So that's where they're referring to it, kind of on that angle. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosened thence, they sailed close by Crete. So the plan was, hey, the wind's just blowing a little bit. We know now what we're going to do. We've made our plans. We're just going to go right over here to the west side of Crete. We're going to hold up there and let this storm pass. But not long after there arose against it a tempestuous wind called Euryclidon. And on the 14th, we'll try to understand some of these things. A tempestuous wind called Euryclidon. It's a cyclonic, tempestuous northeast wind which blows in the Mediterranean, mostly in autumn and in winter. And when the ship was caught and could not bear up into the wind, we let her drive. So they turned the ship northward, wanting to get to that far side of Crete, but it says the ship could not hold up. So what they had to do, basically, it kept getting driven back, so they had to turn their sails, and when they turned their sails with that north wind, what happens? Pushes them south, doesn't it? And it says, and running under a certain island, which is called Clauda, we had much work to come by the boat. Now let's try to understand what that may be entailing, I don't want to go into a lot of speculation, but it says that there's a lot of work going on with this boat. So they've already turned it north. They tried to let the ship hold up, but it wouldn't hold. So now they've got some work to do to the boat, whether it took on a lot of water, whether the ship started loosening up, and they had, I don't know if any of you, some of us went up to see that ark that was built. And the way that they had pulled beams and cross ties that they could pull that thing together, and that they would try to patch up different places to keep it from leaking. But now, by no means was this thing watertight. It was expected to take on a certain amount of water, but they had ways of getting rid of that. But I believe when it talks about that they had much work by the boat, there was a lot of things that had to be tightened up. As in mentioned here in the next verse, I believe it is, it said, which when they had taken up, they used helps, ungirding the ship, and fearing lest that they should fall into the quicksand, strike sail, and so were driven. Now that's a very accurate statement. First of all, it talks about they had taken up, they used helps, they used whoever it was on the ship and said, get to work. We know you ain't shipbuilders, but you're fixing to help us fix this boat. Ungirding the ship so that they had to repair the ship and its girding. Whether this thing started swelling out or whatever may have happened to it, but they were trying to hold the boat together, and fearing lest they should fall into the quicksands. So that geographical area, and maybe even still that way today, on this north side of Africa, it picks up all the silt, just like what we were talking about from these hurricane seasons, all of this pushing down this way, and just like going to a gravel bar, what do you get right on the leading edge of all of that drift? All of this is like real loose sand, and they referred to it as the quicksand. So if your boat got pushed down into that, you get into that sand, you're there, you're stuck. So that kind of put them into panic mode. They couldn't just keep going further and further south. They knew that they'd be in trouble. So now they got to make an attempt. They can't just hold up and float out there for any certain amount of time. They've got to try to get out of there right away. All right, where did we get to? The 18th? And we being exceedingly tossed with a tempest. And that's referring to a violent windly storm. The next day, they lightened the ship. So they started throwing off the things that they didn't need, didn't they? Which would do what? It would make them a little bit swifter, a little bit faster, but it would also raise them up to a higher level that the boat wouldn't be so deep in the water, right? When you load your fishing boats up, boy, she gets heavy down in the back end, don't it? So you go lightening that load and tell a few people to get off and out here on the lake. Hey, we ain't putting eight people on here today, you know. But no doubt they were doing the same thing. They didn't want this boat so deep in the water. And the third day, we cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. And the tackling of the ship would have been all rigging and cranes that were used for loading and unloading the ship. Keeping in mind, this is a merchant vessel. They would have had to have loaded up heavy things and stuff like that. This wasn't just a passenger ship that had a bunch of seats and there's a bunch of people there. I think we'll see later on that there was to the tune of 276 people on there. But it was definitely for shipping merchandise to and from. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. That's pretty scary, ain't it? But after losing abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, "Sirs, you should have hearkened to me." Now I'm going to stop right there. I don't know about any of the rest of y'all, but it sure didn't seem like a fitting time for an I told you so guy to stand up, does it? Especially when you're lightening the ship. I don't know that he wouldn't have been the first one you to grab, you know. That's just a thought I had. Now who wants to hear that at a time like this? Amen, that's right. That's right. So, but that's Paul for you. He never cared what would happen to himself. He's going to tell the truth. And sometimes you didn't want to hear it, but he told it. "You should have hearkened unto me and not have loosed from Crete and to have gained this harm and loss. And now I exhort you to be of good cheer." So exhort, very similar to some of the last, whenever it refers to admonish, it doesn't mean to condemn them or to be hard on them, but exhort means to strongly encourage or to urge. So he's encouraging them to be of good cheer. "For there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve." So he said, the angel of God. Now, he's not serving the angel, but what he's saying is, "I am of God's, and I serve him." Right in the midst of everybody, it says, "Saying, Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all them that shall sail with thee." So, now keep in mind, you've got people on this boat that are Jews. You've got Romans probably on this ship. You've got Egyptians that are on this ship. That's where the ship came from, right? It was from Alexandria. So you got to think there would have been all different kinds of people on here. And Paul gets talking about what his God can do. So he tells them to have good cheer. Now, there's probably some of them doubting in what he says, but there's some of the ones, Luke and Aristarchus, that's been with him, they got a lot of comfort out of this. And the rest of them will, I believe, learn to believe. Or have been given the chance to believe in the one true Almighty God. "Howbeit, we must be cast upon a certain island. But when the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down in Adria, about midnight, the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country." Now when it talks about Adria, that is the area of the Mediterranean Sea. They're in between Sicily and where they had just there left from there at Crete. So that whole area there, that's referred to as Adria. Now here in the 28th, "And sounded and found it 20 fathoms, and when they had gone a little further, they sounded again and found it 15 fathoms. Now, let's try to understand what this sounded means. The sounded, they have something called a sounding line. And this would be a line with a piece of lead or bronze or something to that effect, but it would hang off the end of the chain, and they would basically use this for like an old depth finder. They would fill it full of grease and pack it with grease on the outside. Now, why would they do that? They wanted to know what the ocean floor contained, especially in that area. We just read about that loose sand and what they referred to as that quicksand. But what would that grease do? It would stick to that lead. It would stick to that bronze. And when it went down, if it picked up a bunch of sand, then they knew they weren't in good land to be able to put the ship in. But if it hit a bunch of rocks, then it wouldn't have picked up anything. It would have just probably been dented or maybe knocked off some of it, but there wouldn't be a lot of sand stuck to that. So they'd pull it back up to determine how deep the water and determine what the ocean floor was like. Now, we talked about the differences of their ocean there and what our Atlantic is. Now, where they are at particularly, it talks about there in the 28th, it said it 20 fathoms. Well, a fathom is measured at the average man's wingspan at that time. That would have been about 6 foot. So from fingertip to fingertip, when you spread your arms about, that's pretty close to what I am, so that's about 6 foot, so 20 fathoms there. So 120 foot deep is the water depth that they're in at this point in time. And then it said that they sailed a little bit, and they checked it again, and they found it at 15 fathoms. So now they're around 90 feet. So that's not real deep, is it? So, yeah, they could still have some bad weather. You can go out on the lake. Well, Dale Hollow is 120 foot in several areas. You can find it up to around 150 feet over there. So it's not super, super deep. So that's the other reason why they don't have hurricanes quite like the Atlantic, but they can still have some rough ones out there, I'm sure. Then, fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast 4 anchors out of the stern and wished for the day. So the boat's heading west, northwest, something like that, which is a... If you think about that picture, like that Macedonian call of how the gospel left from where it did and headed northwest, and you continue northwest into Europe, and you continue on around the globe, and where do you come to? You hit America, don't you? But that's how that old ship was facing. But they cast out 4 anchors off the back. So you do that to kind of scotch yourself. Again, you fishermen out there, y'all probably do the same thing. You're coming up in a cove, if you was going to pitch out your anchor, you throw it off a little bit early, let it kind of drag, and that way you grab a hold of something real good and not just try to drop it straight down, because you'll float a long while before it finally drags and catches hold of something. So they throwed out those first because they wanted the back end to be scotched. And then the idea would be that after you do that, you got to throw some off the front of the boat so the front of the boat ain't doing all of this. But it says in the 30th, and as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship when they had let down the boat into the sea under color, as though they would have cast anchors out of the foreship. So what it's saying there is they may have been supposed to have gone and thrown out the anchors out of the front, or maybe they were going to say, we're going to use this boat and we're going to pitch out the front anchors. But it's basically what it means there in under a color, meaning as they had thought to have done, or as they said they were going to do. So they're going against what they had allowed others to perceive. Oh, they're just going up there to throw out the front anchors. No, they were going up there to drop that little boat, and they were going to make their escape and let the rest of them die. And Paul catches them on that there in the 31st. And it said, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, except these abide in the ship, we cannot be saved. So Paul didn't give a direction to this centurion, and he didn't tell him just exactly what he should do, but he did tell him the facts, didn't he? He said, God had already told us we're all going to be okay. Not one hair on our head is going to be harmed if we'll all stay in this ship together. But now we got some that was willing to let all of them perish, and they weren't going to throw out the front anchors. They were going to jump on this ship. It's kind of like a little safety vessel on the side of these big cruise lines. they would let that little boat down and they were going to take off and leave everybody else on the boat. So it says, then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let her fall. So they took that completely away from them. We're in this together at this point. Ain't nobody getting off unless we all get off. And while the day was coming on, Paul besought them all to take meat, saying, this day is the 14th day that you have tarried and continued fasting, having taken nothing. I couldn't imagine fasting for 14 days. That they had to be just weak as water, spiritually and physically, at this point. But it said, wherefore I pray you to take some meat, for this is for your health, for there shall not be a hair fall from the head of any of you. And when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in presence of them all. So again, what's Paul doing in the middle of this storm? He's raising up his God. No matter, this prosperity gospel that's being preached out there in the most of the world right now, of you come unto Christ and everything's going to be just beautiful and wonderful and you're going to have a better car and a better job, I don't find that to be biblical. You follow what Paul does, you follow what happens to Moses, you follow what happens to Noah, you follow any man through this Bible, David, Samson, whomever. At the end of it, just about all of them have endured a lot of headache, heartache, spiritual weakness. It's not to be this prosperous gospel that some of them claim to be, the Joel Osteens of the world. It feels good to hear it, but it just ain't biblical. But Paul was raising up his God in the presence of them all, and when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then were they all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. And we were in all in the ship 216 souls. So the 60 is 20 apiece, so 60. And then you got another 16 to add on top of that, so that makes it 76. So 276. And when they had eaten enough, they had lightened the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea. So they've eaten one more time, cast everything else out to the sea. And when it was day, they knew not the land, but they discovered a certain creek with a shore into the which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust in the ship. And when they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves. And it says taken up, but you can't help but wonder if they just didn't cut them off, drop them off. They were already lightening the load. So you knew the ship was fixing to be cast in. They're going to hit this inlet. But the Bible says it was taken up. Ever how you want to word that. But again, we know they're trying to lighten the load and they're aiming to hit this small gap and they want to get as close to land as he can, because they know they don't have this safety boat with them, so they're going to have to swim out of there. So the less deep the boat is in the water, then the farther in the canal they can go, and the less swimming they're going to have to do. But it said they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves unto the sea, and loosened the rudder bands. Now the rudder bands, there would have been, they claimed that those rudder bands would have been like their steering arms. So it had these big paddle-like beams that would have stuck off the back or the back corners of the boat, and that when the boat was anchored, they would pull them up and they would fasten them to the side of the boat with ropes. So what they're saying here, by loosening the rudder bands, that's what they would do. They would loosen them, they would let their rudders fall in the back, and now they can steer their boat as they're going into this canal. And falling into a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the fore part stuck fast and remained unmovable. But the hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. So it come in and basically slid into the rocks or sand, and it wedged in there. But now the waves is just beating the back end of the boat till it started just tearing the boat apart. And the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. But the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land, just as God had promised. Amen. Any thoughts on any of that?
We didn't know it at the time, but when we went over, then Lisa went over to Rome, and then we backtracked all a big portion of Paul's journey. When we come back, and we started at Rome, and we come right down by Sicilia, and we went north of Crete, where they came south of. But we was, according to geographics, we was within 150 miles where he had actually shipwrecked.
Wow.
Just right there at on the southern side of Sicily.
Wow.
And at the time, didn't have no clue when we come through Sicily how close that was. But I know when I found that out, I just got goosebumps.
I'll bet. I'll bet. Wow. And in the detail that was taken down here for that 27th chapter, again, it talks about the wind direction and everything about it. It gives the layout of the land, and history now backs these statements up, and it's just it's a really, really cool thought there. And again, Luke being a physician, he wouldn't have just wrote this stuff down and for no apparent reason. He done this so that we might believe. To scotch up this Word of God with the truth. And if these new scientists and archaeologists will take this book and use it for reference to find their answers, I'm certain they would find them a whole lot quicker than what they do trying to backtrack into it and then realizing that, well, accidentally we've proven the Bible right. But had they started with knowing the truth was here, then they would have found their answer much quicker. I about promise you that. If nothing else, y'all consider yourself dismissed this morning. Thank you for coming.